Okay, the title of talk is Degrowth. I'm going to begin by talking about growth, then I'll talk a bit about degrowth, which is sometimes called post-growth. I'll ask whether degrowth is possible under capitalism, and then I'll talk at the end about the connection between degrowth and socialism. I should make it clear that degrowth is not a single idea or a single set of policies. Just can look at some of the versions of it, because you can't possibly look at all the different variants that have been proposed. There is no agreed party position on this, although, as we'll see at the end of the talk, something has been said in the Standard about an attitude to degrowth, although not perhaps quite in those words. And so we'll come back to that at the end. And really, what I want to do to a large extent is just start a discussion rather than saying specifically what our attitude is. I gave this talk in a face-to-face meeting in Manchester last Saturday, and some interesting points were raised in the discussion, and I'll mention those at some point later on. Let's begin then by talking about growth under capitalism. Growth in the economy, generally measured in terms of gross domestic product or GDP, is usually seen as being an essential part of capitalism, with countries aiming, or politicians, whatever, aiming to have GDP growth of at least 2% every year. And it's important to remember that growth in this sense is compound growth. So it's rather like compound interest, so that it's not just that it grows by 3% every year. What it grows by is the. So if something grows by 3% one year, then the next year won't grow by 3% of the same amount. It will grow by 3% of the additional amount, taking account of the growth. And apparently, if compound growth happens year after year for 3%, then within 24 years, the economy will have doubled in size. So don't think that 3% isn't very much. Since it's compound growth, it's something that really can take off in a very large way. Growth is frequently emphasized by politicians. So, for example, Keir Starmer recently outlined five missions for the Labour Party, one of which was to secure the highest sustained growth in the G7, the moment the UK is more or less at or near the bottom of that ladder, but Starmer wants things to go much higher up. And the OECD, one of their aims is to achieve the highest sustainable rate of economic growth. So growth, economic growth, is really seen as and is an essential aspect of capitalism. And I've come across terms such as growthism and the growthocene. You probably heard the term Anthropocene, which means a geological historical period in which people have had a major impact on the planet. And I've also come across the Capitalocene, where capitalism had this major impact, but a newer term is the Growthocene, where growth has had this big impact. And if you look at charts and figures and so on, then there's been a massive increase in UK GDP per head since 1800, and in particular since 1900. The Industrial Revolution clearly had an enormous impact on the economy and on economic growth. And what are the consequences of this? Well, one, of course, is that there has been a general improvement in living conditions, life expectancy, etc. But at the same time, the impact on the environment has been extremely negative, certainly in recent years in particular, but not just recently. So a big jump in CO2 emissions, global heating, killing of soil ecosystems, declining crop yields, declining global fish stocks, increase in sea levels, loss of glaciers, etc., etc. And I guess most of you will be quite aware of the kind of thing that's being talked about there. So despite the general improvement in living conditions, there has been a deterioration in much of the environment in which we live. And at the same time, there's, of course, still plenty of hunger and destitution at a global level, but also even in supposedly developed countries like the UK, where there's an increasing use of food banks and still plenty of homelessness and so on. So despite the growth in the UK, etc., and global economy, there's still a great deal of poverty and, as we've seen, a great deal of environmental problems. Now, one solution to this, one we're going to look at specifically now, is degrowth. As I said, there are various aspects and proposals of this. It's not one single set of ideas. So I'm going to begin by looking at it in rather general terms. Then I'll talk about two specific books and their proposals. One account of what the degrowth movement stands for, I'm taking this from the degrowth.info website, which is there on the text in the chat. According to that website, the degrowth movement, quote, advocates for societies that prioritize social and ecological well-being instead of corporate profits, overproduction and excess consumption. And I guess that's a reasonable summary that they generally want social and ecological well-being rather than the profit motive. Of course, the question, of course, is how do you do that and how successful are their ideas? So, for example, most degrowth proponents would be in favour of reducing CO2 emissions to down to nothing or as close to nothing as possible by 2050. Emphasis instead on renewable energy, which is already, of course, spreading, but would have to be used much more widely than it is now. Limit the use of resources such as oil and coal and so on, and energy if possible. Producing less, as we'll see, might well be a part of degrowth. People talk about stewardship of the environment, which is something that the party has recently, I think adopted maybe is not the right term, but at least come to realise is a useful way of looking at things, that we don't so much own the environment as stewardship and take care of it for future generations and so on. Another aspect of degrowth would be to reduce working hours and also to reduce global inequality so that that the world would, in a sort of degrowth-type world, be a much more equal kind of society. And, again, many of you will be aware of the book The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, which shows that increased economic prosperity is not really a necessary condition for increased happiness, that once people's basic needs are taken care of, then increasing prosperity, as it were, doesn't necessarily make people happier. It's more that equal societies make people happier. Again, we can come back to that issue later on if you like. So in general terms then, degrowth is about putting emphasis on the well-being of people and of the planet rather than looking at profit and excess consumption, as it were. The question, of course, is to what extent that is possible within capitalism rather than having to have some kind of socialist revolution to bring it about. Okay, let's look then at a couple of books which provide a little bit more detail. I'll begin by talking about the work by Jason Hickel, Less is More, which is there in the chat list. Hickel sees equality as being a substitute for growth. That's to say, what is needed is not economic growth, but much more equality across the world. He also wants usership, not ownership. That's to say, rather than owning things, we should just have access and being able to employ them and make use of them. So, I mean, people often talk about power tools being an example that, you know, they spend most of their life in a person's shed, and you don't really need to own a power tool, a drill or whatever. You just need to have access to one when you want it. You could say the same thing, I suppose, about lawnmowers, and people often hire bikes and cars and fancy clothes or bedding and so on. So usership, not ownership, is something that could be spread certainly much more widely than it is now. Icker also talks about the right to repair. So many of you will know if something mechanical or particularly something electrical breaks down, then there's a good chance you won't be able to repair it. Instead, you'll have to buy a replacement. But if there was a right to repair that your computer or whatever could be repaired rather than having to be chucked in the bin and replaced, then that would cut down on production and economic growth and so on. He also wants to reduce the... let me have another sip of water. He also wants to reduce the beef industry. He doesn't necessarily advocate everyone becoming vegetarian, but he does want to cut down on the amount of beef we eat and the number of cows that are being kept around the world and, you know, polluting the atmosphere and so on. He wants to shorten the working week. And as, again, many of you will know, there's already been moves to have a four-day week. Hickel talks about abundance as an antidote to growth, as an antidote to growth. He doesn't really explain very much what he means by that. More interestingly, he talks about a steady state system. What he means by that is, don't extract more from more than ecosystem can generate themselves in terms of energy and so on, and so on. Also, but don't pollute more than ecosystems can absorb. So don't take more than can be produced there, and don't dump more rubbish there than can be absorbed. That's what he means by a steady state. And that all sounds, most of much of it, I guess, sounds pretty good. You know, shorter working week, right to repair, etc. Unfortunately, he also advocates things like a global minimum wage, a maximum wage. I don't know whether the maximum wage is meant to stop the profits of the capitalists or not. Wealth tax, a government policy which is needed to guide private investment, and talk about cancelling debts of the global south and so on. So despite some of what he says being perhaps fairly positive, there's also much of a negative side to it. And also, he's a bit of a fan of Cuba. That doesn't get out in the book, but I've seen it in published occasions elsewhere. He's rather fond of what's happening or been happening in Cuba. And Hickel talks about a post-capitalist world, but unfortunately, it doesn't really seem to be, since there will still be wages and wealth and private investment and so on. So, like so many people who have, you know, some ideas of what's wrong with capitalism, he doesn't quite go beyond it to stand for something rather different. Okay, the other book I want to talk about is the one by Callis et al. Called The Case for Degrowth. Again, that's listed in the chat. And what they propose is five what they call path-breaking reforms. And we'll see how path-breaking these are or are not. The first one is a Green New Deal without growth. And what they mean by that is net zero emissions of CO2, millions of high-wage jobs and so on. That is, New Deal, Green New Deal is meant to stimulate employment and so on, but to do so within the framework of a green system, which supposedly will defend and support the environment. UBI is their second one, UBI and universal basic services. So universal basic income and universal basic services, so things like housing, healthcare, education and so on, should be available to everybody, though it's not entirely clear whether all of that will be free or just some of it. Talk about reclaiming the commons. That's their third path-breaking reform. So natural areas, parks, even buildings, which should be in use generally as social centres or whatever, they should be reclaimed. So as you'll know, much of the countryside is, you know, not really available to most people, but it needs to be reclaimed. Their fourth path-breaking reform is to reduce working hours, the four-day week, which we've talked about before, and even under capitalism, something like that is happening for some workers anyway. And their last one is public finance to support all of those. So there'll be a taxes on pollution. You'll have to pay a fee. A company have to pay a fee if they emit too much carbon and this kind of thing. So, although these are indeed reforms and not revolutionary, they are still stuck in the present economic system. There will still be governments and wages, and presumably there'll still be a class system and so on. One thing they do talk about, which is interesting, they talk about a circular economy, recycling, reuse, and renewable energy and so on. I guess that is rather similar to the steady state approach that Hickel talked about that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So whether you call it steady state or circular economy, you know, you recycle and so on, reuse, whatever, yeah, as I guess people to some extent do nowadays. Okay, so as I said, there's a great many different varieties of policies around degrowth, and what I've just mentioned now is a reasonable outline of what some of them propose, but of course there are others too. So next question, is degrowth possible under capitalism? And I think socialists would argue very much that the answer is no, it's not, because capitalism without growth is simply not possible, or at least only for very short periods. I mean, clearly there are recessions and so on, but capitalism as a whole really relies on accumulation and investment and so on and so on. And it's also the fact is that many degrowth ideas assume the continuation of capitalism. After all, that universal basic income, which pays everyone a certain amount of money, that after all assumes money and wages and so on will continue. There'll be carbon taxes, there'll be a maximum wage and so on. So many, not necessarily perhaps all, but most degrowth ideas do assume the continuation of capitalism, despite the rhetoric that you get from some of the people. So, as I said, Hickel talked about a post-capitalist world, but unfortunately it still has so many of the hallmarks of capitalism. Right, let's get on then to the final point I want to talk about, which is the connection of degrowth to socialism. I guess you don't need me to tell you what socialism is as a society. But what I would say is that happiness and a feeling of content and so on is not a matter of the extent of consumption. So I talked earlier about the spirit level and the work around that idea. And what they see, the authors of that book, is that inequality is far more important in terms of making people feel happy and secure and confident and trusting and so on, is a more equal society rather than one in which people simply have and consume more. And there's also this World Happiness Index, which I wrote about in the Standard a year or two ago, I think. Again, the societies which have the highest scores for the happiness of the population aren't necessarily aren't always the best well-off ones. So it's not US and Japan and so on. It's more the Scandinavian countries tend to score rather better in terms of the happiness of their populations rather than places where consumption and so on is seen as important. So maybe to be happy, you don't have to have masses of consumer goods and so on and so on. In the Socialist Party, we've often so rather than being a consumerist society, perhaps another concept, another word that we should use is, this is enoughism. What you want is enough, not lots and lots of things. Yeah. When I gave this talk the other week in Manchester, last week in Manchester, Gary Cornwall pointed out that there'd been a poll done by YouGov, I think, in a number of European countries, including the UK. There's a link in the chat to the Guardian's write-up of this. And what they asked people across various countries was what was their attitude to climate action and action to mitigate and the effects on the climate. And most, on the whole, people were keen on action being taken, but as long as it didn't affect their lifestyles. So they were not so keen on cutting out meat. And I think that word is dairy. I can't read my own writing there. Yeah. People weren't so keen on cutting out meat and dairy. And they weren't keen on having higher fuel duty. They weren't keen on having fewer children as a way of sort of reducing the impact of humans on the planet and so on. That is, of course, very much the way people react under capitalism. And it's worth reading that Guardian article, I think, just to see what people's views are. There are issues to whether people really will be happy to support some of the consequences of degrowth, at least. So the idea would be at least that within degrowth within the socialist world, there would be a greener environment and, of course, no poverty. If we just think for a second about the kind of things that people need, people's needs, and I'm going to talk about four different aspects of people's needs. Firstly, there's security. And we can talk about that in terms of material security, having somewhere to live, enough food, etc. Also in terms of sort of physical security, not being subject to floods and heat waves and that kind of thing. Second is that people want to feel part of a community, whether it's neighbours, friends, relatives or whatever. And loneliness is a very big problem under capitalism. The third thing people want is they want to be competent and effective. They want to be good at something and feel that what they do is useful to the wider society, whether that's as nurses or teachers or plumbers or whatever. And lastly, people want to be autonomous and to feel in charge of their lives rather than being pushed around all the time. And I think we would say that can be done in socialism, but it could certainly be done in a sort of degrowth type of society as well. Something else that came up at the meeting on Saturday in Manchester, we often talk about, say, that capitalism restricts production because of the profit motive with the slogan, no profit, no production. But as Peter Rigg pointed out in discussion in Manchester, there might well be a tension between this idea that capitalism restricts production and to what extent we would want to expand production in a socialist society and how that would fit into degrowth. So without wanting to say that there's a simple answer, there's a kind of tension between degrowth and a kind of abundance. Maybe we don't talk about abundance so much as we used to in the party. And a term I've used sometimes is an effective abundance. That's to say, enough for people's needs and so on, but not enough for people to have masses of pairs of shoes or two sports cars each or whatever. So there'll be, in a socialist society, there will not be the kind of accumulation which takes place under capitalism. And of course, we have to accept too that there are lots of global issues and so on. So in many countries, for example, water scarcity is quite a big problem. That's the kind of thing which a socialist society would have to solve. And we'd have to ask too, how long would it take to transition to renewable energy completely and to this steady state system, if that's what people want. I said at the start that there wasn't really a party position on degrowth and so on. And I thought that until, as it happens, a few weeks ago, I came across the following quote from the February 2022 Socialist Standard. Again, this quote is there in the chat if you want to look at it in more detail. And what it says is this: socialists propose a steady state, zero growth model of the economy for the future society and envisage an anti-consumerism trend to prevail with an expected drop in consumption levels following an initial phase of higher production to raise impoverished to a decent standard of living. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but it's news to me that that is a sort of the agreed party position, that there's going to be a zero growth model of the economy. Maybe there is, but I'm not sure we should be quite so definite and maybe dogmatic's the wrong term, but could be quite so definite and sure that that's the way things are going to work. So to conclude then, I think degrowth is an important issue. It's not an easy one to solve. Certainly socialists now can't come up with a simple degrowth model for the future because we don't know how much worse things will be by the time that socialism is established. But I think the kinds of issues that the degrowth people raise are important issues and ones which socialists ought to, at the very least, be aware of and talk about and discuss. Okay, that's it. Thank you.